Today in Cold September, the final cut, which at one time, many years ago, was going to be the last Barney Thompson novel, hence the title. Final Cut first appeared under the title Limited Edition in German translation in 2004. It was at the time fifth in the series. It finally made an appearance in English in 2009, and at that point it was a wrap for Barney. I left him happily attached to Sergeant Monk, living in Millport. That lasted all of about 3 months, then I wrote what at the time was known as the Westminster Christmas Massacre, now an ebook, as The Final Days. It was another 9 years before Barney returned in novel form. The starting point for The Final Cut, as suggested by the original title, is marketing agencies with their limited edition bars of chocolate, absurd prose and promises, and the desperation of trying to get you to buy something you're really, really not going to need. I felt the young male marketing executives all kind of blending into one as I wrote the story, so I gave them all names of famous 20th century writers to try and make them more identifiable. I was probably being ironic and suggesting that the marketing guys might be the great writers of the day. I don't actually remember. I should probably just say that yes, I was being ironic. That's what I'll tell Alanis if she ever calls. The killer in the book, a hired assassin, is named Harlequin Sweetlips. I'd seen a small fish in the London Aquarium with that name and I thought it perfect for the killer. This is the one that featured God as a character, gave him a New England accent and made him look like Michael Stipe. I have no idea what I was thinking with either of those things, certainly not that Stipe might be a deity or that God might be an American, God forbid. But that was what was in my head the day I wrote it, and they survived the editing process. So here are a few scenes from The Final Cut, as ever presented in random narrative form. The waitress appeared beside him as she had done repeatedly throughout his 1 hour stay. She was always more attentive to customers whom she found attractive. She was no different from any other member of the world's waiting collective, and Barney had the disenchanted look about him that she so loved in men. Tired eyes, but eyes that showed depth and intelligence and wisdom. She tried to make conversation, but he hadn't been interested, and she consequently found him all the more beguiling. "Can I get anything else?" she asked, the third time she'd used those words to start her approach. A poor second to, "Is everything all right for you, sir?" Barney looked up, confident enough in himself to recognise the attraction, but not interested. He knew he had the look about him, the look of the traveller, the look of one who walked amongst men, restless and weary. Women loved that, but he also knew he could never be as interesting as they hoped he was going to be. He was running from life, the strangulation of attachment and community. He was no warrior. "I'm all right, thanks, Selina," he said. "I should be going shortly." "You can't go out in that," she said, wishing that every word which left her mouth could be more erudite. "Places to go," said Barney. Selina, name badged in a dwelling world, stared at him and wondered what it was that this man had to go. Somewhere dangerous, she imagined. The eyes said as much. The rest of the people in here were taking a break from shoe shopping or were about to go off to meet their mother-in-law or their accountant. But this man, he'd drunk 3 cups of tea and eaten 2 pieces of cherry pie. He would have grander designs.
"Oh, there they are, darling," said a man's voice behind her. "You can stand there ogling that bloke all day. Get us a cheese sandwich, love."
Selina smiled at Barney, no trace of embarrassment. "Got to go," she said. Barney smiled and said nothing. "You're welcome," Selina added as an afterthought, and turned round to the next table, to the man who was after some mature cheddar. Barney turned and looked once more out of the window. During the brief intercourse with the waitress, the rain had begun to ease, although not yet enough for anyone to venture out from undercover. He checked his watch again, lifted the cup to his mouth, and looked outside at pools of water dancing with the raindrops. 35 minutes later, Barney was off the Docklands Railway and walking the short distance to the building which housed the offices of Bethlehem, Forsyth and Crane. Checked the small gold nameplate screwed into the wall, pressed the buzzer and waited. The rain had all but ceased, but there was a cold wind bustling down here from the river and he pulled his jacket tightly around him. "Hello," cackled at him. Then he looked up into the small camera which was showing him to the receptionist and the security guards on each level of the building. "Barney Thompson, barber," said Barney, and immediately the door buzzed. He pushed it open and he walked into the domain of the 7th largest advertising agency in Britain. Up some stairs, around a corner, through another door, and he was into reception. The waiting area suggested everything you'd expect from a modern, chic marketing operation. Sleek, minimalist Scandinavian furniture in pale colours, a few stark modern pictures of nothing in particular, painted in pallid blues and yellows, abrupt chairs built for style rather than comfort, and a tremendous feeling of freshness and light and cleanliness. almost as if there was a giant invisible panty liner soaking up all the dirt and darkness and grime. They made TV adverts in offices like this. The receptionist was sitting behind a clean lined desk of pale brown veneer, straight backed and elegant, her fingers surgically attached to her keyboard. She wore one of those little microphones in front of her lips as if she was Madonna, at any minute was liable to start gambling full chested around the room singing like a prayer. She went by the name of Imelda Marcos. Not the Imelda Marcos, mind, although she was partial to a new pair of shoes and was ready for Barney with a clipped smile and eyebrows that almost met in the middle. Mr. Thompson. Was 10 seconds ago, said Barney, already tired of the purity of it all. If there had been a marketing agency reception on the little house in the prairie, it would have been this clean and wholesome. You're 3.5 minutes early, said Imelda, the smile vanishing, never to return. Would you like a drink? What have you got? Asked Barney, looking around the area and choosing to sit down in an ergonomically designed comfy chair with cushioning to sit the average Scandinavian backside. Imelda Marcus's back was up. There'd been the 10 seconds ago sarcastic remark, and now the bloke had the temerity to sit down without first being offered a seat. Her voice rattled out, Gatling gun, rapid fire. Latte, espresso, decaf, New York decaf, cappuccino, El Grey, Lapsang Souchong, Darjeeling, ice, hydrogenated mineral water. Barney crossed his legs. Cup of tea would be nice, he said. PG tips if you've got it. Imelda gave him the stare for a few seconds, pressed a quick button and spoke into her like a prayer microphone. Cup of English breakfast for Barney Thompson, she clipped. No sugar. The offices of Bethlehem, Forsyth and Crane took up all of a 10-storey block in Canary Wharf. Joe Forsyth had negotiated a long-term deal on the property in the mid-90s, picking his moment during a bad week, and it looked like the market might lose the momentum it had built up after the calamities of 92. With the change of address in the letterhead from Birmingham to NE14, the fortunes of the company had changed overnight. Ever since, the story of BF&C had been one of growth and increasing market share. The departure of the last remaining founding partners other than Bethlehem, they had been originally five in all, had seen barely a blip in the rise of the company as the sheer bravado and exuberance of Thomas Bethlehem had seen him through potential difficulties with clients initially attracted by either Forsyth or Margie Crane. Forsyth had gone quietly, the culmination of endless disagreements with Bethlehem over the ethics of the company and their business. Bethlehem wanted to have fun, sleep with lots of women and make huge amounts of money. He'd known all along that Forsyth's idealism made him easy meat for the carnivores of the world of marketing, so that when the going got tough, Forsyth got going. Crane had departed after an incident with a Lebanese prostitute and two sachets of illegal drugs that had left her position untenable. Knowing his feelings on women, she presumed she'd been set up by Bethlehem, although she hadn't. So she'd left with a chip on her shoulder, albeit quietly, and with her tail between her legs. Despite the fact that her departure had meant a far bigger slice of the cherry pie for him, Bethlehem had almost been sad to see her go. Crane had started a small firm in Birmingham, pitching for the bottom end of the billboard business. Bethlehem had lost interest the minute the two of them were out the door, and their names, Margie and Joe, had become the bywords in the company for the general public, the masses out there who read The Sun and The Mirror, who watched Anton Deck and Corrie and EastEnders, who played football and drank in the pub, who wore their cell phones like cowboys wore their guns, and who were there to be duped and controlled and made to buy any old shit that people like Thomas Bethlehem were paid to make them want to buy. Barney turned as the door opened and his first customer of the day, the first of his new position, walked into the small office which had been converted overnight into a barber's shop. There'd be no money exchanging hands, however. Barney was paid as an employee of the company, and other employees would get their hair cut in the company. Thomas Bethlehem was that serious about hair. Barney lifted himself off the barber's chair. They'd been sitting at the 10th floor window looking out in the Thames. Morning, said Barney. He knew from his appointments list, already handed him by Imelda Marcos, that this was Hugo Fitzgerald, head of television contracts. Michelle nodded, hung the jacket of his suit on a hanger and slid into the seat. She then swiveled round away from the window so that he was looking in the large mirror. He settled back, opened up a folder he brought in with him and waited to be set upon. Barney knew that Fitzgerald would be expecting to be asked what he wanted, but he could see that this was a man whose head demanded a jejun but appropriate Brad Pitt. And so, with an apposite cape tossed around his neck, Barney picked up his new razor, flicked the switch, felt the old familiar buzz in his fingers and got to work. Michelle glanced up quickly from his folder and said from underneath a raised eyebrow, Brad Pitt? Aye, said Barney. Brad Pitt? Michelle nodded appreciatively as if relishing a fine cup of coffee and looked back at his folder. Barney handled the nod so as not to remove any ears and kept about his business. 2 days after they'd left Millport, seamlessly transported to another life. Barely 20 seconds and Vichelle tossed the folder onto the counter under the mirror in front of him in an act of almost childish petulance. With how it looked, Vichelle straightened his shoulders and caught Barney's eye in the mirror. The rubbish I have to put away, he said. Barney raised an inquiring forehead. Here we go, he thought. Confessional. Sometimes made the day go a little more quickly, sometimes made the day an horrendous, god-awful nightmare. Could go either way. You client, said Barney. Vichelle checked Barney's eye in the mirror again. Yeah, he said. You get a nose for this stuff? I'm a barber, said Barney. Vichelle held his gaze for another second, then lifted the folder and held it in front of him, as if this would allow Barney to see inside. Savor these snacks. God, said Vichelle. It's come to this. Savor the flipping snacks. Which company? Asked Barney. Dundee Salted Snacks, said Fitzgerald, the words falling out of his mouth as if they were being pushed off the edge of a cliff. They do fisherman's chips, don't they? Asked Barney. Yeah, said Fitzgerald, grudgingly. That's a good crisp. Tasty and crunchy. Pretty big company too, I'd have thought. Not so big. Must be Columbia TriStar next to your Channel 5. Fitzgerald raised a different kind of eyebrow this time, but people were going to have to learn. When they hired Barney Thompson, they got it told to them straight. Lovely analogy, said Fitzgerald. Fact is, they're a dinosaur. We need to be getting a bigger share of the telecoms business, not this prehistoric, antediluvian, stuck-in-the-middle-ages stuff. Crisps. Everybody eats crisps. Exactly. Crisps. Any idiot can sell crisps. I don't want to be selling crisps. Got to be a lot of money in it. Yeah, it's all right, but we need money combined with kudos, you know what I'm saying? You don't get a steam in this business doing adverts for five-year-olds featuring old footballers. Look, he said, becoming a little more animated so that Barney took the wise decision to suspend the hostilities of the cut until his customer had calmed down. What does that amount to? How do you market crisps? One, TV. Two, regardless of how gobbing your product is, make it look cool. Three, get Alan Shearer or some other ex-footy player who's instantly recognisable to the thickest mince populace. Four, get wise with your packaging so that salt and vinegar becomes sea salt and balsamic vinegar, cheese and onion becomes blue cheese and chive, smoky bacon has to be oak smoke, pork and caramelised banana, blah, 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 usual stuff. That's about it. God, the public are too flipping stupid to know any better. Tell them anything you want, they'll lap it up. The brief conflagration having died down, Barney resumed working. You're nice, he thought. But he resisted the brief temptation to give him Pitt the Younger rather than Brad Pitt. Well then, said Barney, why not just do it and move on? Give the man his spit roasted pork and red Leicester flavour, take his money and shuffle him quietly out the door. Don't worry about it. Don't bleat. Just do it and go on with the next job. If you do it well, no one's going to denounce you for having taken the work in the first place. Fitzgerald stared straight back at himself in the mirror. His mouth was watering. He quite liked the sound of spit-roasted pork and red Leicester-flavoured crisps, even this early in the morning. He might use that. Not that he would tell Barney Thompson. Barney silenced the razor in order to brush some loose hairs from the mechanism. He took a moment to look out in the river, corrupted grey under cloudy March skies. Had the sense that the conversation was over. The confessional had not turned out so bad after all. As he blew across the top of the razor and looked back down at what was turning into an absolutely superb Brad Pitt, Fitzgerald rested further back against the chair and closed his eyes. You might be right, he said, as he felt the hum of the razor against the back of his head. You ever heard of Bing Crosby? Hugo Fitzgerald smiled, making good eye contact. The evening was going well, as his evenings with women did. The general day-to-day frustrations of the office had been left behind, principally because he felt he was beginning to nicely control the whole Exxon contract. This evening's meal had gone for Gordon Ramsay. The guy was so yesterday that Fitzgerald knew he was being innovative in returning to him, because there's nothing more chic than retro. A velouté of cauliflower with a brunoise of scallops to start, followed by Dorade Royale with ragu of blet, round it all off with oven-roasted caramel bananas en papillon. Strathpepper, mineral water, and elegant Pouligny Montrachet. Of course I have, said Harlequin Sweet Lips, and Fitzgerald nodded. Name me some of his songs, he said, smiling. The meal was passed. They were sipping at their cups of New York decaf and nibbling sexually on those mints they had been buying from the small chocolatiers at the far end of Bond Street for the past 5 years. Sweet Lips was playing her own games. Not so easy, is it? Said Bethlehem. White Christmas, she said, taking the edge from a fondant mint, the chocolate melting in her tongue. A Moonlight Becomes You, that was one of his. Fitzgerald nodded, smiling. He polished off his glass of Montrachet, lifted the bottle, hung it over Sweetlip's glass, although knew she wouldn't take it, then poured the remainder into his own glass at the shake of her head. You know he never sung a note, he said. How do you mean? Maybe she was bored. Maybe it was time to get on with the evening's main event.
It's one of those big Hollywood secrets that people don't talk about. He made his first film, early 30s sometime. The producer signed him up because he thought he had the right look. Young, yet mature, take him home at your mum, boy next door, crap. Trouble was, he couldn't sing a damn note. Bing Crosby, not a damn note, said Fitzgerald, holding his hands out in sincere gesture. The smell was broader, so those dimples appeared in his cheeks. They drafted in some other guy, even weirder to look at than Bingo, and did the singing. A wee Jewish fella. So what happened? Sweet Lips ran her fingers around the rim of her empty wine glass, an elegant creation, the small cup perched on top of a slim 6-inch stem. She thought Fitzgerald was all right, hopelessly lost up his own rectal passage, but that came with the territory. Despite all the crap, he was a decent enough chap, and the dimples made him look cute. She could almost fancy him, just the same about what was going to happen. Well, said Fitzgerald, leaning more closely towards her, that first movie was huge. She had to do another one. Next thing you know, boom, Crosby is bigger than Jesus. The studios were stuck with him. Crosby was stuck with a wee Jewish fella. Sweetlips sat back. Her blouse had an oriental neckline, but the heavy silk of it lay wonderfully in the curve of her breasts, far more alluring than any brass show of cleavage. Wasn't the Jewish fella fed up, she said, playing along. Hell no, he loved it. He was quite happy hanging around in the background. Lived his life in some prodigious mansion in Beverly Hills. Plenty of money, plenty of women. He didn't care, it was perfect. She stared at him, the smile a fraction under her lips. Nah, she said eventually, don't buy it. People would have known. Of course they knew, said Fitzgerald. Hell, at first everyone in the business knew, but in those days, there were all sorts of secrets. Every second star was gay or lesbian or a lizard. Jesus, all sorts. Still are. Next to that, the Crosby thing was nothing. And eventually just got forgotten about. That's how these things go. She quietly let the faintest edge of a smile come to her lips. All right, she said lazily. It's possible. It's a crazy world out there, Harley, said Fitzgerald. Now that, I do believe. So what do you think? He asked, and his face moved a little closer across the table, his forearms flattened out. His eyes were bright, his teeth were white. True or false? Bing? Yep. She started to give it some serious thought, then decided to be magnanimous. Give the poor sod one last triumph to take to his grave. True, she said. Not entirely convinced, but I'll buy it. The smile widened in Fitzgerald's face, and now the dimples, and close inspection, Ashley looked a little disfiguring. Nice try, Batgirl, he said, and the eyebrows were raised to accompany the smile. I made it up. Well, I'm shocked, she thought. She giggled and threw her head back. See what I mean? That's how it is these days. Fact is, Harley, you say anything in life with conviction, you'll be believed. They'll fall for that every time. Lower fat? What the hell even is that? Who cares? The Pond Life still buy the damn stuff, and when they don't lose weight, they blame it on the 15 bottles of Tesco's chili and chinine they quaffed at New Year's. People buy any crap you tell them. If you look them in the eye and mean what you say, that's what we're good at. The company is awesome, he continued, as she was giving him some space. He was warming to his subject, built into the climax that would result in the evening's conquest. We're totally going to be kings. That's why you're making a good move, babe. Bethlehem is good. Orwell's good. But you and me together, we can be better than any of them. Still, she said, the smile a little more wicked than before. Only the 8th biggest in Britain at the moment. 7th, he said. 3 years ago we weren't in the top 20. Now we're kicking butt. Thomas for sure, but all of us. Another 2 years and we'll be up there, especially with you and me at the helm. She ran her finger along her bottom lip. A fine, final eruption of enthusiasm from the lad Fitzgerald, she thought. And now presumably he'll make his move. Good luck to him. Fitzgerald incorrectly read the whole finger along the lip thing. But that was inevitable, given that he had known the true agenda of Harlequin Sweetlips. It was pretty much a dead cert he wouldn't have invited her to dinner. It's time, he said. She nodded. His hand shot out. He grabbed her roughly by the hair and brought her head forward so that their faces met across the table. His tongue plunged into her mouth. Her head twitched. Her lips matched his. She took it for a few seconds, then bit hard onto his tongue. His head shot back, surprise in his face, tasting blood in his mouth, but a smile broader than before, the pain flaming his desire. He loved pain, loved it when he fought back. That was brutal, he said. She didn't say anything. Her eyes blazed. Let's do it, he said, leaning forward. She nodded. Yeah, she said. Let's. She lifted her empty wine glass and held it up to show him as if offering it for the toast. He looked at her quizzically, assuming she had some weird sexual thing in mind. But when she moved it, it was with speed and grace, an almost balletic quality to the motion. She brought the wine glass down on the edge of the table, so the cup snapped off with a loud crack at the top of the stem and spiralled into the air. Then in the same flowing movement, she brought the stem up and plunged it into his right eye, threw the ball and deep into the socket, forcing it in the full 6 inches so that the base of the glass rested up against his face.
The initial spurt of blood was arrested by the bottom of the glass, so that as Fitzgerald pitched forward, his head thudding noisily on the table, the blood squirmed uneasily from underneath the glass and began to spread across the white tablecloth, which had, up until now, only been despoiled by a smidge of blood. Then she caught the cup in its downward spiral. She drained the dregs from the glass, pushed her chair back and rose to her feet. She looked down at the back of Fitzgerald's head, the blood now spreading to contaminate his Harvey Nichols smart but casual. "Brunoise of scallops," she said softly. "Pretentious little shit." And with that, Sweet Lips lifted her bag, took out the small kit she had brought along to wipe the scene clear of evidence while planting more evidence along the way, and got to work.